The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. The Interspatial Accessibility Compact's Guidelines for Cross-Cultural Engagement by Diane Cutler. It's said that no one can hear you scream in the vacuum of space, but here on the station, sound carries a little too well. Adaptive audio mufflers, sound dampening, building materials, and wave disruptors have become a lucrative cottage industry. We make a lot of accommodations up here. Take the roses, for example. I keep a stock of tissue paper roses for the earth people. Most of the time, they're happy with plants and flowers that thrive in space. But a devoted contingent keeps track of the dates down below, and once a year, they come in demanding roses. The first 2 years we had earthlings up here, I tried to sell them on the standards. Dorfanian lushes, sorge planks, baskets overflowing with whorling finds. Some bought, but I had at least two break down in the kind of hysterical sobbing that indicates a grade 3 homesickness diagnosis. One had to be escorted to the infirmary. Since then, I've sourced these. There's a paper artist on station L47 who does gorgeous flowers. I don't even think the roses are their best work, but they sell like fizz pops. Earthlings have other problems. They're far more prone to allergies than most of the species up here. And thanks to the Interspatial Accessibility Compact, I have to protect their overly curious and fragile bodies from a host of pollens, spores, and forms of radiation to which they're vulnerable. Honestly, no species has a greater death wish. Tell a hollux to stay 3 meters from anything purple and dusty, and you don't have to ask twice. I've never had a Lotran try to argue with me when I tell them the hibiscus they've been admiring will make them break out in a rash if they take it home. Earthlings, though, they'll interpret a warning as an invitation. And since the High Court ruled that it's an inextricable component of their fundamental character, I have to lock up anything that might kill them or make them itch. So when Tadaki stopped by the shop, I thought I knew what he wanted. Tadaki was a frequent customer, slightly more adventurous in his botanical interests than the average earthling. He was one of the first biologists from the Earth Squad to move up here permanently, and while I appreciated his interest, his particular earthling death wish tendencies were double that of his comrades. He was the reason I had to erect particle barriers around anything, from Jicky to Hollum. The number of times I heard him gasp, "It's fascinating," before passing out covered in hives basically made it his catchphrase. "Tadaki," the vocoder that allowed my voice to carry at a pitch he could hear, always made me do a double take. Hearing myself, I thought I sounded like I was scolding a small child for misbehaving with deeply exaggerated tones. When I told Tadaki this, he assured me that to earth-cultured ears, I sounded warm and welcoming, if a little monotonous. "Sri-chan," he replied with a customary baring of teeth. "I hope you can help me today." This was unusual. Tadaki rarely asked for my assistance. "What do you need?" Tadaki leaned against the counter and dropped his head into his hands. "I have a problem," he announced in a muffled voice. "Sri, what do you know about love? The way earthlings do it or the way we do it?" "Define we." "At least 4 different cultures on this station. The Hollisks are outliers, as are earthlings. The rest of us work pretty similarly." Tadaki looked up. "Tell me about Hollisks and love. Compared to earthlings? Borderline incompatible. There is a complete absence of gesture, which makes sense, given Hollisk biology and social orders. If a Hollisk brought one of my paper roses, for example, would a life mate, it would be considered an insult." "Why? Why? What would they do with it?" "Good point. It doesn't really work with their aesthetic." "Exactly. Imagine trying to navigate this place entirely by echolocation. The number of textures alone would overwhelm you by lunchtime, and that's before we get to all the noises. You'd want your quarters to be a refuge from that, too. Which also explains why you can't just tell a Hollisk you love them." The words came out rushed, as if he hadn't thought about them before he spoke. That, too, was unusual. I paused. "Tadaki? Do you mean to tell me I was right about you and Lilith?" "Shut up," Tadaki muttered into his hands. "What is love anyway? I heard somewhere it was supposed to feel good." I turned sideways so I could slide my tail across the counter alongside Tadaki's arm and tried to emanate warmth and comfort at a frequency he'd register. "You've been burrowed up in that lab for months together. Earthlings pack bond with just about anything. We know that. It was bound to happen. Better Lilith than a piece of sentient lab equipment." "Yep, that's me, fulfilling my biological imperative," Tadaki said. "But my efforts don't meet with approval." "Something like that virus you picked up on Jiki last year? You're dehydrated and have a blistering rash on your..." "No, Siri. But the general feeling of crawling out of my skin, yes." I frowned. "But you don't mold like that. It's a figure of speech. It means I experience constant low-grade discomfort and a hyper-awareness of my body and surroundings." "Oh, you're disintegrating."
"I'm what?"
"Disintegrating. It only happens for an hour or so, though, at least for us. It's an indication that we've found our mate. There's a short period of adjustment where our biofrequencies calibrate and reintegrate to accept the permanent presence of another. I heard it can feel disorienting. It never happened to you?" "Tadaki, look around. Do you see a mate anywhere near me?" "So basically you fall in love for an hour and then you're just chill for life?" "It's better than what's happening to you, if Lilith is actually your mate." "Can't argue that. I have no idea how it would work with such broadly incompatible species, though." "Thanks, Sri. That's incredibly helpful of you. Not to mention the fact that you've been disintegrating for days. I'm not sure any of us would survive that. Your capacity for relentless discomfort is almost disturbing." "I promise you," Tadaki said vehemently, "it's not a consensual experience." I could see we weren't going to get anywhere with this. So what brings you here? The station counselor would have much better information about how Usk mating habits. I'm just a commercial botanist. Tadaki looked up. Okay, so, on Earth, flowers and plants, they mean things. They're a covert language of affection that's been reinvented and reimagined every couple of centuries. Or decades. I don't even know which half of them mean, but that's why the Earthlings are so into roses. Roses mean love, unless they mean friendship or something. Tadaki, how in all of space is anyone supposed to understand that? I don't know, Tadaki whined. That's the problem. Every time I go into the lab and he's there, I lose all sense of rationality, logic, and sense. Today, I got obsessed with the idea of bringing him a gift, and this is the only place I know where I could probably get him something he might care about. Ah, so you are trying to make a gesture. Yes. To a member of a species that actively eschews gestures. Yes. Because you have lost your rational mind to disintegration. Yes. Tadaki, what? Have you considered asking him? Tadaki immediately fell into a disastrous response that mimicked some of his allergic reactions. I was reaching for the emergency intercom when he held up a hand to stop me. I'm fine, Sri, but the thought of asking him, as you can see, is enough to give me half a heart attack. Why? Isn't it better to know if you're compatible? Wouldn't that ease your distress? But what if we're not? Then you can proceed as lab mates. No, now you're overestimating my capacity for discomfort. Knowing I have feelings he doesn't reciprocate would be like... He looked around the shop and settled his gaze on one of the restricted sections. Like spending the rest of my days trapped in the same room as a Lorton stink tree. That nearly killed you. Exactly. A soft chime rang. Tadaki and I looked up toward the entrance at the same time. It was easy enough for me to conceal my amusement, but the poor Earthling didn't have a chance. His face instantly paled, sweat broke across his palms, and he radiated enough panic to override the comfort I was still trying to offer. I raised my tail until the Hollisk acknowledged my greeting. Then I poked Tadaki. Hi, Lilith. Hi, he croaked. Lilith, who Tadaki said, once resembled an armored manatee on wheels, rolled from the entry down the wide path to the counter, his flippers tucked securely against his trunk to keep from touching anything, accidentally. My senses weren't as finely tuned as another Hollisk's would be, but something felt slightly off. What do you need? I asked, carefully choosing as few words as possible to keep his hypersensitive auditory processes from overloading. I quickly reached down and turned off the faint music I had playing, wishing I could do something about the persistent hum of the humidifiers. I came for him, Lilith replied. Tadaki crouched down so he wasn't towering over Lilith, which unfortunately took him under the lip of the counter and out of my view. Lilith focused on his lab mate. The whiskers at the end of his snout trembled slightly. You have been away, Lilith said, his voice just high enough for Tadaki to hear. I have been alone in the lab. I know, Tadaki replied softly. I have been... unwell. Lilith shivered. I'd never seen the Hollisks do that before, but the distress was evident. Infirmary? He asked. Not that kind of unwell, Tadaki said. You idiot, I wanted to tell Tadaki, but there was no way for me to convey that without Lilith picking up on it. So I aimed a message for Lilith at a frequency too low for Tadaki to hear. He is in distress because he can't interpret your... I searched for a word to replace feeling and came up short. I rephrased. He wants to be assured that you don't find him a burden. Had I known Hollis could do so, I could have sworn Lilith looked indignant. It's just an earthling condition, Tadaki continued, oblivious. It's fine. I'll be back in the lab tomorrow. He's lying, I said to Lilith. I know, Lilith said, audibly addressing me. I am not imperceptive. Something thumped against the underside of the counter, followed by a wince and a gasp from Tadaki. Stop talking about me, he hissed. Lewinch flinched at the intensity of the sound. You need help, I murmured back. Tadaki, said Lilith. The name rolled over his audible voice in a way that was almost musical. You are distressed. Yeah, Tadaki admitted miserably. Do not be distressed, Lilith said. Tadaki chuckled slightly. It's not quite that simple for earthlings. Lilith emitted a low-frequency sound that could have been interpreted as a sigh. You are essential, he said aloud. In the lab, you are not a burden. Surely even Tadaki knew enough to understand what that meant to a Hollisk. I'm not, he asked. I wanted to slap him. Being with you, Lilith said slowly, is like being alone. I'm boring, Tadaki squeaked. You're peaceful, I growled as quietly as I could. He's saying you'd be welcome in his quarters, you know, the place where he goes to get away from all the overwhelming noise. Oh, Tadaki's voice was small. Being with you is like being alone for me, too. Satisfied, Lilith turned and started rolling toward the door. I saw Tadaki crawl out from under the counter, twisting around to look at me. I sighed and turned away, flicking my tail to shoo him out and resumed the music as he left. Tadaki's euphoria radiating all the way across the shop. Do Not Hasten to Bid Me Adieu by Will McMahon. Hal didn't look at the mailbox as he scrubbed his hands. Squatting in front of his shack, he'd tried to distract himself, thinking up new jokes to tell the young WPA painter when he was laying primer for the mural tomorrow. He kept not looking at the mailbox as he dunked his hands into the bucket, turning the water a murky gray. Watched pots and all that. He wiped dry on yesterday's newspaper, a picture of President Roosevelt staring up at him in black and white. He rose from the squat real slow, knees popping. Phew, not that old, he muttered. Still, his train-hopping days were long behind him. After dumping the bucket off to one side, Hal finally approached the mailbox, stomach knotting. He'd only written to Helen and Tom last week. His letter probably hadn't even made it to California yet. But it had been a few months since he'd had word of Charlie. He'd said he was doing well on his last leave, and it couldn't be easy getting mail out of Spain these days. Still, he pulled the flap up. Empty. He let out a breath. Well, maybe tomorrow. After going inside, Hal took out a can of beans and a bottle of beer from one of the wooden crates that served as his pantry. He put the beans on the table for later, but cracked the warm beer right off. Rifling through a drawer, he pulled out his stack of letters. Taking swigs from the bottle, he reread Charlie's last letter. More and more these days, Hal was feeling like the world was moving all around him, and he was sitting still, old and forgotten, just waiting for letters to come from thousands of miles off, one way or the other. It was sitting less well with him lately, but he still wasn't sure what he wanted to do about it. Finishing Charlie's old letter, he was about to start on Helen's last, the one little Jim had scribbled all over. when he heard an odd noise from out front. Half convinced he'd imagined it, he got up and stuck his head out the door. Like he thought, nothing there. He idly popped the mailbox open again. There was a packet sitting at the bottom of the little tin box. Snatching it out, Hal stared at the strange envelope, bright purple, paper thin, and crinkly. No address, no postage. He peered out into the night looking for whoever had dropped it off. He still couldn't see anything. Shaking his head, Hal brought the envelope inside. Sitting down by the lamp, he turned it over in his hands, curious. He broke the wax seal, a honeybee pressed in gold, and drew out the delicate cream paper, scrawled in purple ink. There was a sharp, sweet smell. He read, "Honored ancestor, I write to you, casting this missive back through time, to beseech your wisdom. I, your humble descendant, am princess of an empire stretching from Orion to the Seagull Nebula. The strong foundation you laid has borne great fruit, as our family has risen high over the millennia. It is not joy that compels this letter, however, but despair. I am the only daughter of the Empire, and my father has commanded I marry the Patriarch of the Central Persian Protectorate, our ancient enemy and a man of his own age. While the old Patriarch holds no appeal for me, I lack even the justification of loving another, as might be sung in the romances. I have no one, and I know the weight of this alliance, forging peace between our empires and uniting our armadas against the anarchist hordes of outer Perseus. And yet I despair. I feel like a petulant child. It is the lot of an imperial daughter to be dealt as such. But whensoever I consider the matter, I cannot breathe. I have lost the will to live. I sit despondent to the rooms I must leave, staring out at the gardens I must leave, and know that it is for no heroine's adventure. No path of my own forging, but to become the chattel and broodmare of an old tyrant. I write, honored ancestor, begging an answer of your wisdom. How can I live? How do I face what comes? The wisdom of those who built this empire is sacred and unyielding. I have always been taught, yet I have found no answers in the memoirs and texts of my father's library. So I cast these letters into the currents of eternity and await anxiously your reply. Yours faithfully, Princess Inanna Uma Ninsun, Empire of Orion." Hal was thoughtful as he cut open the can of beans. Thoughtful was a nice word. Distracted, more like. He howled as he slid his thumb on the can's ragged edge. He alternated between spoonfuls of lukewarm beans and sucking the blood from his cut, mind still elsewhere. "Princess Inanna Uma Ninsun, Empire of Orion." He sat listening to President Roosevelt's fireside chat on the radio as he carefully scooped out the last of the bean juice with a finger from his uninjured hand. Afterward, he washed the spoon, then sat back down at his table. He took out his packet of nice letter paper. After staring at the blank white page for a while, he began to write. "Dear granddaughter, I don't know how what you say can be true, but I'll take your word for it. I was glad to receive your letter and am happy to hear of our family's prosperity. It is otherwise in my time, but sad to read about your troubles. I do not know if I can be of much use. I'm afraid. I am not well acquainted with these matters, not being of any royalty and having married just the once, under somewhat difficult circumstances. I am brought to mind of certain parts of the book, Little Women, which I read to my Helen countless times when she was a girl. She is married now, off in San Francisco with her husband and boy, but of her own choice. Good luck forcing that one's hand. It sounds like you are very far away, so I don't know if you have that book. I only mention it because you said you have a library there. I don't think the book will answer your question, but maybe it will help. My Helen loved it. Come to think of it, if you are some great-great-granddaughter of mine, however that may be, then I wonder who by. Do you know if you come down through Helen or through my son Charlie? My wife passed 5 years back, and I know I ain't got any more in me. Just curious. Again, very sorry for the troubles. Feel free to write again. Your grandpappy, Henry, U.S. of A. He sealed the letter in an envelope, then wrote, Inanna Uma Ninsun, Empire of Orion, on it. After a moment of uncertainty, he peeled the stamp off his small sheet and affixed it to the upper right corner of the envelope. He dropped it in the box outside before extinguishing the gas lamp and lying down to sleep. Dear Grandfather, thank you so much for your response. I sent 20 copies of my letter back through time. Most of the ancestors who received it did not reply. A few wrote back expressing their disbelief. One said to quit yapping and do your duty. Your letter, by contrast, was deeply appreciated. I regret to say that I do not know from which of your illustrious children I claim descent. Our family histories and patents of lineage go back millennia, but as there are no Henrys or Charles listed, and the few Helens have fathers of different names, your time must be quite remote from my own. This device was looted from the tomb of a lost civilization, and I do not know how it works, only that it is a means of converse with one's ancestors. My father's library contains an archive of ancient texts in which I found the story you named. I had the library translate it for me, and I read it last night. It was wonderful. Is that what your world is like? I loved all the girls, but Jo especially. I did not like that she was married in the end, but at least it was her choice. I can see why your Helen loved it so. She must be a wonderful woman. Perhaps if I learned to work the artifact better, I might write to her, too. I am curious about your son Charlie. You say Helen is off elsewhere? Is he nearer? Despite your fear to the contrary, your letter has helped a great deal. It and the book have made me feel a little less alone, even if my plight still looms. Please do write again. Your granddaughter, Princess Inanna Uma Ninsun, Empire of Orion. Dear granddaughter, was that last one my great-granny Nellie? She passed when I was 6, but that sounds just like her. Quit yapping. Sorry to hear most didn't write back to you. That's bad manners. I'm glad you liked the book. Been years since I read it. Helen took our copy west with her. Funny you should say that about Jo. She always felt the same. Though I should ask her again, now that she's married herself. I'll tell her to watch out for purple letters. If you can't figure it out, I can always forward them to California for you. No, sorry to say Charlie's not at home. He is further out. You ask if my world is like the book. Well, yes and no. It was written round the American Civil War, which was about 1861 to 1865. It's 1937 now, so a good few years have passed. But some things don't change. There's a civil war in Spain now. The fascists, those are real bad guys. Hope you don't got any of them. Are trying to take over the country. got the army and the police on their side, but the people rose up to stop him. The call went out and Charlie answered. He's over there with the Lincoln Brigade, a bunch of American boys who volunteered, and they're gonna lick the fascists. I'd have gone myself if I was a bit younger. Been a lot more worthwhile than the last war I was in. Charlie's most recent letter, he was in good spirits and real funny, talking about how bad the food is, how they're singing in the trenches and yelling across the fascists, making fun of them. It's funny you said in your first letter about your pa trying to fight the anarchists there. There's anarchists in Spain, too, but they're the good guys, or some of the good guys. Charlie said he spent some downtime with a few of the anarchist union's militia, and it was near half women. How about that? I said. Don't tell Helen. Ha, but I think it's great. As many women as there are men in Spain, sure. They join up and they'll have those fascists good and outnumbered. It's been lean years here, but things are getting better, I think. We got President Roosevelt, and he put everyone to work. I'm at the WPA now. That's Works Progress Administration. They put me with a brilliant young painter up from Mexico, doing murals on public buildings. I'm laying primer for him, helping cart stuff around. He even says he'll teach me to do background work on the murals. How about that? This old dog ain't out of tricks yet. I'm being a bit long-winded, sorry. Tell me more about you. How's your ma? You think she might be able to talk to your pa for you? Before Ruth passed, I'd always listen to her. About the kids or just about anything else. Anyway, I got a beer and a nice mess of beans for dinner, then off to bed. Early morning tomorrow. Looking forward to your next letter. Agree. It's good to be talking or writing. Your grandpappy, Henry. Hal got up an hour before dawn. He rolled out of bed, stretching his knees. Felt like a good day. That was a relief. He'd be going up the ladder today. When he had his coffee, he stepped out to check the box. It was early spring yet, and the pre-dawn chill clung to the air. But he was curious if last night's letter would still be there. It was not. A now familiar purple envelope sat inside. Not exactly keeping to regular mail hours, he muttered. Nobody tell the NALC. He weighed the thin envelope curiously. It was heavier than before. Taking care with the seal, he was saving them, he opened it and eased out the letter. There was something else inside, a delicate piece of glass, 2 inches square. Within the thin crystal, a young woman sat. No more than 20, he judged. She was painted in shining brush strokes. He could swear her bound black hair and bright green dress shifted as he watched. She didn't look much like him. But that wry expression, that was all Helen. It took his breath away. He stared at the painting a while longer, then opened the letter. Dear Grandfather, I am amused to report that the yapping note was in fact signed Nellie. It seems our lineage is filled with interesting women. Charlie sounds like a fine young man. I am saddened to hear of the wars in your time. As you say, some things do not change. In our epoch, billions have died and worlds have burned in the endless wars between our empire and the crusaders of the Protectorate. Now peace is brokered only to turn out our combined might upon the riven worlds of Outer Perseus. Charlie's description of the anarchists of your time does not match the stories of bloodthirsty hordes I have heard in mine. As I cannot vouch for the veracity of my father's propaganda, I will bow to your son's experience. I am certain your son and his compatriots will prevail. I searched the archives, but your time must be remote indeed. There are a few passing mentions of a land called Spain, but I could find little detail. Nonetheless, his cause sounds worthy, and I hope our family's future prosperity serves as some evidence favoring his success. It is good to hear that your times are getting better, and yes, you must learn to paint. It is such a joy. I spend endless hours sitting on my terrace overlooking the gardens, gazing out at the roiling gas giant vistas beyond, painting what forms and movements come to me. You can fall into yourself, brush in hand, and forget all your troubles for a time. No one has taught me how to use the artifact as I am, I confess, operating it somewhat illicitly. If its capabilities are known to my father's scientist, then no one has shared them with me. The pedestal from which the letters depart is sizable. However, so I hope that it might carry more than paper. I have included a self-portrait in this letter to show you a glimpse of me and my world, and to encourage your own painting. Please do tell me if you receive it. Until the next, I remain your granddaughter, Princess Sinana Uma Ninsun, Empire of Orion. P.S. I am gratified that Helen and I are a mind of Joe. P.P.S. No, my mother is of no help. Hell's knees had held up all right after all. He'd been a bit unsure climbing the ladder, but had got used to it pretty quick. They'd worked fast today, and he'd been let off a half hour early. There was still light in the sky as he got home. After he'd washed up, he took the little glass painting out of his shirt pocket. He'd brought it today, thinking to show it off to the young painter, but hesitated, afraid he'd sound like a fool trying to explain where it come from. She did move, just a little, but he was sure. The fine strokes glowed. If he cupped his hands around the glass, he could see it shed faint light on his callous skin. He shook his head in wonder. Putting the painting back in his pocket, Hal went to the mailbox. His heart skipped a beat when he saw the battered, stained envelope within. Snatching it out, he stared at the front. Addressed to him in a familiar hand, the postmarks told a long journey, Madrid to Paris to New York, then a long train ride to him. He tore it open, starting to read before he'd even finished unfolding the paper. "Dear Pa, if you're getting this letter..." He fell to his knees, shaking his head. "Dear granddaughter, well, I guess I know who you come down from now. I am sorry that it has been some days since my last letter. I have gotten some bad news. Charlie was killed in the battle at Jarma Valley. I had read of the battle in the paper a month ago, but I didn't know. I got a letter Charlie wrote in case he died, and another letter from his commander. He had very fine things to say about Charlie, and some of the other boys wrote notes too, which was nice. I spent the better part of 2 days in bed, not eating or drinking. The young painter came and found me and got me up and moving again, and I suppose I should thank him, but it doesn't matter much in my head, to be true. I can't stop thinking I should have gone with him. I ain't that old. There was no stopping Charlie. You should have seen his face when those men from Spain came to the hall and gave their speeches. Charlie was a good Union man like his pa, and he wasn't going to abide such a thing. I'd never seen his face like that before. No, there was no stopping Charlie. But I'm thinking I should have gone, should have tried. It was a hard thing losing Ruth, but it's another thing losing a son. He should be the one burying me. Not that I'm even burying him, as he's lying in Spanish soil now. Well, that part is okay, I guess. He fought for those people. I'm sure they'll take good care of him there. I did get the painting. It is mighty fine. You are a great talent. I'm sorry to hear about your ma. I wish I had better advice for you, but these days I'm getting a lot of headaches and having a hard time keeping my mind off Charlie. Do keep writing, though, granddaughter. A reminder of life is good in dark days. Your grandpappy, Henry. He wouldn't say he was doing better. He was just numb. He went back to work, and the young painter was real gentle with him. Took him out for a beer and some food after they got off, probably to make sure he was eating. Hal was quiet at first, nursing his beer. The painter filled the silence, telling Hal all about the big Mexican muralists, none of whom Hal had ever heard of. Yes, Rivera was foundational, the young man said. That could not be denied. Siquerios was very skilled, but his work was tainted by his abominable politics, plain as anyone could see. Orozco, though, there was a painter for the dark soul of the age. Hal nodded politely along. Slowly, though, as one beer turned into three or four, Hal started opening up. He'd repeated what he'd written in an impossible letter, that he wished he'd stopped Charlie or had gone with him. The painter smiled sadly and told him about how his own father had been killed back in Mexico during the Revolution when he was just a boy, and how he still had dreams of begging his father not to leave. Moved by this recognition of his own pain in another, Hal raised his glass and together they toasted their dead. Not wanting to stop, they toasted all the foreign volunteers in Spain, and then Lázaro Cárdenas, because sure, wasn't Mexico sending the guns and aid that America and the rest weren't? And then the young painter, who had drunk even more than Hal, began a litany of revolutionary dead from Zapata to Villa. But when he grazed a glass to Ricardo Flores Magón, Hal said he'd met the man, sure, 20 years back in Los Angeles when they were both running with the Wobblies, and what was done to him was a right crime, and Wilson would have had him voting against the Dems for life if FDR hadn't come around. And the young painter exclaimed and embraced him and called to the bartender to ask if they had any mezcal. And when it transpired that they did not, they settled for whiskey and had a shot each for old Magón. And then another two for the souls of a son's father and a father's son, buried in Oaxaca and in Jarama. And as Hal staggered home, supported by this brilliant young man who missed his father so much, he felt himself coming to a decision. He'd been waiting on letters for too long. A week ago, Hal would have said he had two children. Now it was one, only one, still one. So when he woke up the next morning, bleary-eyed and head-pounding, he nevertheless set about his business with a renewed sense of purpose. And when he got home again, holding the train ticket close to his heart, it was with the feeling that he had turned a page. Yet no decision, no catharsis, absolves one so quickly of such a loss. And so, despite his newfound resolve, Hal was unprepared for the letter that waited for him in the little tin box. Dear Grandfather, I am so grieved to hear of your loss. Does not the universe have some limit to tragedy and injustice? Charlie sounds like he was a man of great passion and resolve. I am honored to be of a line with him. Do not blame yourself. It sounds that you gave him love and strength and raised a son who chose a hard life in the service of others. A loss so great cannot truly be reckoned with, but I think to honor him for what he did and who he was is to begin. I have finally found something of your time. I searched the name you gave of your son's resting place, Jarama, and found this song in a cache of military intelligence on Outer Perseus in my father's archives. I do not have access to the appropriate translation protocols, as preventing the spread of anarchistic propaganda is of paramount importance to imperial security. Still, there is a word that stands out, and I hope you will take it as evidence that your son did not die in vain, that his sacrifice is honored down the aeons. I regret that this may be one of my final letters. I am soon to be shipped to the court of Central Perseus, and the artifact shall remain here in the house of my father. I shall endeavor to write again if I am able, but if I am not, I wish to thank you deeply for your correspondence. Hearing of the lives and loves and dignitaries of a past age and of a family unlike what I have ever known has given me strength. I shall carry you and Helen and Charlie and the beauty and tragedy of your world in my heart as I face what comes next. Thank you so very much. Your granddaughter, always, Inanna. Hal stared at her name in that smooth flowing hand for a long time. Finally, he slipped the thin glass square out of the envelope. It was like the other, but instead of a picture, there was a glowing red circle. Tentatively, he touched it. The soft, ethereal voices seemed to be coming from all around Hal. The language was beyond anything he had ever heard, but he was perplexed to recognize the tune. Red River Valley. The words slipped past him, all but one, repeated time and time again throughout the alien song. Jarama. He wept. He fell onto the bed, playing the song again and again. The familiar melody, the voices and instruments beyond foreign, the name of Charlie's grave as clear as anything. A year later, Hal would hear the song once more, in English, and sung by Woody Guthrie, and he would weep again. All that night he lay curled in bed, listening to the ethereal voices, until exhausted, he finally slept, dreaming of green valleys and a palace in the stars. In the morning, Hal went out to the station again, one change to make. The events of the world had shattered Hal's family. The girls, too, he thought. All those years ahead of him. But Hal knew the same thing Charlie had, the reason he'd never have stopped the boy. When the world dumps on you, you don't take it sitting down. You stand up. You pull together. You make a path. Or you try. Returning home, he sat down to write. Dear granddaughter, thank you so much for the song. You cannot imagine what it has meant for an old man in his grief. I am packing up. It's a long way to California, but Helen's the closest kin I've left now, and I'd very much like to see her again. I cannot bring myself to tell her about Charlie in a letter, and I figure her little one might like to meet his grandpappy. My friend the painter knows some folk doing work out in San Francisco way. He gave me some names to ask after. Even said he was thinking on heading out that way himself when the murals are done here. Inanna girl, I've been thinking, just how big is that thing you use to send the letters and stuff back with? I don't know how any of this works, and it sounds like you might not either. But I'm thinking maybe you could send yourself back. Your pa would be right pissed, I'm sure, but it sounds like he deserves it. I ain't gonna lie to you. It's a hard life, and harder for some than others. We ain't got much money, and you'd be a foreigner here. That shouldn't matter, but it does. You'd be fighting just by living. But you'd have me and Helen and her family and nobody to tell you what to do or who to marry. There's a lot of work for painters with the WPA, and this fellow's got a very fine recommendation letter as a painter's assistant in case you're ever looking. I'm clearing out soon, and I've got two tickets for two fine seats on the last train tonight. I'm thinking Helen won't mind much. I'll sit here and wait a while. Your grandpappy, Henry. He folded the letter into an envelope and wrote a name on the front. He put on his jacket, checked the two tickets tucked in the pocket, and stepped outside. After placing the letter in his mailbox, Hal came back inside and sat at the table's lone chair. He could wait just a little longer. Long enough to see. Running his fingers over the smooth glass surface of a portrait in miniature, he kept his eyes on the door.